All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you very much. Be seated, please. Good morning. Welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court session today in Van County. And thank those in Van County who made our stay here very pleasant and accommodated us very well. So we thank all the staff, our park administrator and others who made it easy for us to be here. And we thank all of you for being here today to hear us discuss this important case entitled Cook v. Van Orden, appeal number two in this case for involved. This case is brought by Dexter J. and Shelley Van Orden, and they're represented by J.D. Oborn, and the respondents, Roger and Shelley Cook, are represented by John Stanquist. Counsel, do either of you have preliminary matters for the court before arguing today?
No, Your Honor.
All right, the Chief Justice.
Oh, that's fine. Thank you, sir. Then you may proceed, Mr. Oborn.
May it please this court, Chief Justice and Counsel, as stated, I am J.D. Oborn and I represent the Van Ordens. Roger and Shelley Cook claim they have a prescriptive easement over a road referred to in the trial of this matter as Tower Road. Tower Road crosses property that is now owned by the Van Ordens. The Cook's predecessors in interest in their family, the Harkers, homestead the Cook property in 1908 and started using Tower Road to access their property as a point of ingress and egress. The Harkers used Tower Road over the Van Orden property when the Van Orden property was wild, unimproved, and unenclosed, giving rise to use those permissive, presumptively permissive. The properties owned by the Cooks and Van Ordens were previously leased at the same time by the Thompsons after they were purchased. The Thompsons used Tower Road to access and farm all the properties that were involved in this matter. The Thompsons used the road in common with the Cooks' predecessors, the Van Orden's predecessors in interest, and with the general public. The trial judge determined that the Cooks had not established the third element of a prescriptive easement claim, that their use of Tower Road was adverse and under a claim of right. Thus, the claim was denied and judgment was entered in favor of Van Orden's after the initial trial. However, the trial court did not identify the prescriptive period, and the Cooks appealed, and as was mentioned, this is the second appeal. In Cook 1, it was remanded, and after on remand, the trial judge determined the prescriptive period that it started in 1908 when the Cook property was homesteaded, but that there was another period that arose as well, and that was in 1962 when the Cooks and their predecessors in interest started to use Tower Road under a claim of right. However, the trial judge again determined that the Cooks' use was not adverse at any time, either after 1908 or with any inciting incident after 1962. The trial court specifically stated, nothing in the record shows any act or conduct on the part of the Harker family which indicated that the Harkers' use of Tower Road was either adverse or that any adverse use was clearly indicated to the Thompsons. Yet the trial judge determined that this court's decision in the prior appeal in Cook 1 established that the Cooks did not have to establish that their use was adverse, but that it was only under a claim of right, that by establishing that it was under a claim of right, that was sufficient to establish the third element of adverse and under a claim of right. As such, in the trial judge's clarified findings of fact and conclusions of law after remand, he concluded that the use was not adverse, but was under a claim of right, which was sufficient to establish the third element of a prescription. The Van Ordens have appealed that decision because the trial court erred in its reading and application of this court's decision in Cook 1. Because the trial court should have denied the prescriptive easement claim after finding that the Cooks did not establish that their use of Tower Road was adverse, even if it was under a claim of right. The elements of an easement by prescription are important, and they were reiterated at least twice in the Cook 1 decision. The elements of prescriptive easement are articulated very well in the Bachman decision. It says, a party seeking to establish the existence of an easement by prescription must prove by clear and convincing evidence that use of the subject property is 1. Open and notorious, 2. Continuous and uninterrupted, 3. Adverse and under a claim of right, 4. With the actual or imputed knowledge of the owner of the surveying tenement, and 5. With a statutory period of 5 years.
that court went on to say that a determination that a claimant has established a prescriptive easement involves entwined questions of law and fact. Each element is essential to the claim, and the trial court must make findings relevant to each element in order to sustain a judgment on appeal. And I think this is where the trial court first went astray, is that it tried to break apart the elements and not find that every part of every element was essential to the claim. When this matter was first addressed by this court in Cook 1, the case was remanded for the district court to determine the relevant statutory period for the claimed prescriptive easement, and then determine whether the evidence established adverse use during that time period. On remand, the trial court determined the statutory period. But then the trial court also determined that when the use of Tower began in 1908, by the Harkers, that use was permissive. The trial court determined that the use never became adverse and that there was never any act or conduct by the Harkers, the Cooks, or any of their predecessors in interest that indicated that the use of Tower Road after 1908 or 1962 was adverse or gave notice of adverse use. The issue giving rise to this appeal is that the trial court determined that the holding in Cook 1 changed Idaho law and the third element of a prescriptive easement claim from requiring the Cooks to establish that the use was adverse and under a claim of right to just establishing that it was sufficient to find that the use was just under a claim of right.
So I'm struggling with that representation of the district court's decision, because as I'm looking at his decision, the bottom of page 39, he says the Idaho Supreme Court's treatment of the adverse and under a claim of right elements suggests that the Cooks and the Thompsons' common belief in the Harkers' right to use the Tower Road and the Cutout Road equates to an adverse use under a claim of right. So I'm struggling with your argument that he separated them. It seems like he's saying, I'm compelled by Cook 1 to conclude that this constituted adverse and under a claim of right. So can you help me understand, why do you think he broke them apart?
And so for all purposes, he subsumed them into a single, the third element that has two parts, adverse and under a claim of right, into a single under a claim of right. So he basically says that this court, as law of the case, basically instructed him that if a claim of right was established, that was sufficient to establish adverse use as well. The reason I believe that he draws a distinction between the two is because he doesn't look to this court's long history of interpreting adverse use and defining what constitutes adverse use. And so...
Well, he does, doesn't he? I mean, at the top of page 39, he says, under Fuquay, HFLP, and Bachman, this court would find they failed to show adverse use. And then at the bottom of the page, he says, essentially, I feel compelled or obligated, I think is the word he uses, under Cook 1 to say that this is sufficient.
Right. But what he says then is he doesn't understand how this court got to how it kind of subsumed these two parts of the third element into a single element of under a claim of right. That he believed that there, because he even distinguishes this in his later in his decision when he identified a separate part of adverse use and a separate section on under a claim of right, and determines that there is no adverse use under the traditional view and interpretation of adverse use, that there is no adverse use here by the Cooks. And then he goes on to then evaluate the second part of the third element, which is under a claim of right, and then establishes they did it with the belief that they had a right to use the road, and that's sufficient to establish the entirety of the third element, both the adverse use and the under claim of right portions of that third element. And so in reality, he's saying that he felt that he was instructed by this court to treat that as a single, and the two parts of that third element as a single element of, or that part is satisfied entirely by merely showing that it's under a claim of right, regardless of whether the use is adverse or not. Because he ultimately determines the use in this case is not adverse, but that they're still entitled to prescriptive easement because they establish or believe that it was under a claim of right. In Cook 1, this court in Cook 1 reiterated some of these key points of law that I think are important here, that to succeed on a prescriptive easement claim, a party must prove adverse use, not just
that they're exempt from the right, but actual adverse use. This court then cited Beck 7.1 that for the law that the nature of the use is adverse but runs contrary to the servient owner's claims to the property. Merely believing that you have a claim of right does not go to the nature of the use itself. That's why it's important to distinguish between the two parts of the third element, that of adverse use and that of under a claim of right. Because if it's under the claim of right, it goes to the mental beliefs, the ideas, the conception of the use, and not the nature of the use itself. The holding in Cook 1 did not consolidate adverse use. The holding in Cook 1 did not consolidate adverse use with claim of right, but still required distinct showing of adverse use. That's my reading of the Cook 1 decision. Using power over merely under a claim of right is not asserted by adverse use in any way. Does not establish that the nature of the use itself is contrary to the serving owner's claims to the property. Thus, adverse use cannot be established simply by use that is under a claim of right. This court of Cook 1 also clarified that the presumption of permissive use still applies, as stated, the presumption of adverse use is inapplicable, and rather permissive use is presumed if the serving estate is wild, unenclosed, or unimproved land. This court then went on to clarify that for a serving estate to utilize the presumption of permissive use, the land must be wild, enclosed, and unimproved, and clarified that was an and not an or when applying this presumption. This presumption of permissive use is important because a prescriptive right cannot be obtained if use of the serving estate is permissive. So this goes back to the trial court's decision. The trial court correctly found that the use of Tower Road by the Harpers was not adverse. However, then the trial court erred in granting the prescriptive easement based on the finding alone that the use was under a claim of right. The trial court correctly found the Harpers and Cook's use of Tower Road was permissive starting in 1908, and that no action was taken that changed the use from permissive to adverse. In Bachman case, again, the court held that the state of mind of the users of the alleged easement is not controlling. Instead, the focus is on the nature of their use. Again, this draws a clear distinction between adverse use and the nature of the use and the state of mind as well. And both of those are necessary to establish that third element. The trial court and the Cooks rely on a statement from Cook 1 that adverse use may be established if the users can demonstrate that their use was not based on a grant of permission, but rather consisted of assertive conduct founded in common belief that they had a right to use the road without seeking permission. Where I believe the error comes in is a misreading of this basically summary of the elements, or what is required to prove adverse use. Because the Cooks and the court focus on the latter part of that statement and not the entire statement. They focus on that adverse use can be established by conduct found in a common belief that they have a right to use the road without seeking permission. But they ignore the part that says that it requires assertive conduct and proof or that it's established that use was not based on permission. So instead of using adverse use, this quote uses assertive conduct. And instead of under a claim of right, it uses common belief that they had a right to use the road. But this doesn't, just using different verbiage does not change the law. The statement does not purport to change the law of adverse use. It still requires assertive conduct or adverse use and the belief in a right to use the road or being under a claim of right. In this case, the Harpers and others believe that the Harpers had a right to use the road, but that alone is insufficient to establish adverse use. The Cooks have not established that use was converted from permissive use to adverse use by any assertive conduct, if we're going to use the language from Cook 1. As stated in the Hughes case, the mere use of property alone is insufficient to establish a private prescriptive easement. Rather, the claimant must perform some independent act signifying to the owner the adverse user's claim. And so again, it's not the belief alone, but it's the conduct and how the
the property is being used in determining whether or not the claim has been satisfied, the elements of the claim have been satisfied. The undisputed testimony from trial from Shelley Cook is that the Harbors started using Tower Road to access the Cook property when they homesteaded the property back in 1908. At the time, the Harbors homesteaded the dominant estate. The Van Orden property was wild, undeveloped, and unenclosed. The evidence in the record is that it wasn't until the 1960s that any development occurred on the property when it began to be farmed, and it wasn't until 2017 that the property was enclosed. In the HFLP LLC case, the court stated, if the serving estate is wild, unenclosed, or unimproved land, the presumption of adverse use does not apply. Rather, permissive use is presumed. Moreover, if the presumption of permissive use applied when the use began, the presumption continues until a hostile and adverse use is clearly manifested and brought home to the surveyant property owner. Consequently, when a plaintiff claims a prescriptive easement over wild or unenclosed land, mere use of the way for the required time is not generally sufficient to give rise to the presumption that the use is adverse. This is still controlling law. Code 1 merely clarified that for this presumption of permission to apply, the serving estate must be wild, enclosed, and unimproved. Under this standard, the trial court correctly determined that the respondent's use of Tower Road was not adverse because the serving estate was wild, unenclosed, and unimproved when the use of the Van Orden property and Tower Road began. The Van Orden land remained wild, unenclosed, and improved again until the 1960s or 1970s, and unenclosed until the 1970s. The presumption of permissiveness applied when the use began, so starting in 1908, and that presumption continues until a hostile and adverse use is clearly manifested. In Cook 1, this was described as assertive conduct. In this case, there's never been any evidence of hostile or adverse use of Tower Road after 1908 that would be that would clearly manifest to the owners of the Van Orden property that the use was adverse. The trial court correctly determined that the permissive use by John Harper I of Tower Road never ripened into adverse use after 1908. Again, the mere use of property alone is insufficient to establish a private prescriptive easement. Rather, the tenant must perform some independent act signifying to the owner that adverse use was planned. And that's what we're missing here. There's no independent act after 1908 signifying any adverse use. The codes in the trial court focus exclusively on the part of Code 1 that says the adverse use may be established if the users can demonstrate conduct founded in common belief that they had a right to use the road without seeking permission. The problem is they remove essential elements of the claim by no longer looking at the actual use or the nature of the use, instead just going into the mindset of the parties using the road. The Cooks focus on this belief that the evidence that their belief that the use of Tower Road is under a claim of right, but they never rebut the presumption that the use or establish any assertive conduct on their part or at any point in time that the use was being changed from permissive use and use that was common between the owners and occupiers of the Cook property and the owners and occupiers of the Van Orden property. Again, if a use is commenced as permissive, a user must make some new and independent act that would put the owner of the serving property on notice that the use is no longer permissive. The evidence identified by the district court shows that the use after 1962 was not adverse, or that there was any assertive conduct after 1962 that would establish adverse use. Instead, the evidence of the conduct after 1962 shows that the use wasn't adverse. There was a key given to John Harper, to access the gate across Tower Road. The use was in common between the owners and occupiers of both properties. The use was in common and the same as the members of the general public. And then later, Roger Cook asked for, the Longquist, the immediate predecessor in the interest of Van Ordens, for permission to put a new lock on the gate. Thus, the trial court correctly determined that there was no adverse use here, but was incorrect when it granted the prescriptive easement based solely on the second portion of the third element of belief that they have a right to use this claim.
So, Mr. Oborn, what's the remedy that you seek?
So it should be remanded to the trial court to enter a judgment consistent with its finding that there was no adverse use here and the prescriptive easement should be denied. The Cooks have requested attorney's fees in this case, and I'll just address that briefly. This is a case in which the trial court believed that this court was making a significant change or at least clarification to established law, and so this claim is not frivolous, and so attorney's fees are not appropriate in this case. Unless there's any questions, that's my part.
Thank you. Mr. Stenquist, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Justices and Counsel. May it please the Court. This appeal should be denied because it established all the elements of prescriptive easement. And the only element that's on appeal today is the third element, adverse and under a claim of right. This case is unique. We have testimony from both the dominant estate holder and the serving estate holder that for at least 60 years, both parties believed a prescriptive easement existed, and they both testified that they acted accordingly. The Harkers farmed it, they leased it, they used it as their own. They never stopped and asked for permission. They were given a key, and they sued once access was cut off. The Thompsons also acted in accordance with this belief. They improved a portion of the road for Cook's benefit. They turned others away, but would not stop the Harkers. They treated the Harkers as if they had a right in every way. They required the Harkers' neighbors, the Grovers, to ask for permission. And those actions, uncontroverted by credible testimony, along with the district court's finding that this occurred as early as 1962, established all of the elements of a prescriptive easement as of 1967. Use by a party consistent with ownership, combined with the testimony of the servient estate that they knew and acted in a manner consistent with the claim of right, is necessarily adverse to the servient estate's rights. And I would propound that all use is adverse, contrary to the rights. So by separating this idea, we're using the property, but it's not adverse, is conflated. When the Thompsons assert a right of ownership, and someone is traveling across that property, traveling across in and of itself is adverse.
But I think the wrinkle here is that there was a presumption, the district court applied the presumption of permissive use, because it was wild, unenclosed, and unimproved. And so are you asking us to overrule our decisions in HFLP, Fuqua, and Bachman that say when a use begins as permissive, there needs to be an asserted act?
I don't think the court needs to overrule that, but simply underscore the court's instruction to both district courts and the bar at large that we need to disentangle ourselves from adhering to these presumptions in every case. So, for example, presumptions are used when facts are not available. Presumptions are used to fill in the blank. Presumptions must take the facts of the case into the account. This is the disentanglement principle that this court outlined in Cook 1 and in prior cases. And presumptions must look at the purpose of the presumption. So, for example, there's no need to fill in the blank and utilize the presumption when the Harkers obtained the key to the property. In other cases, that presumption was used to show that the key was permissive. But in this case, we had testimony from Shirley Thompson that said the Harkers had a right. That explains why they obtained the key in 1980. So the prescriptive period was established by 1967. The gate was built in the 80s. They obtained a key in the 80s. Why did that happen? Well, we know As to more specifically the question, in 1908, Judge Simpson found that it was most likely that the area was wild, unimproved, and unenclosed. There's no evidence in the record about the state of the land. The only evidence that goes back that far is essentially Shelley Cook's testimony from her family history that they never asked for permission. There are no maps from that period of time. There are no photographs.
But as I understand it, you haven't challenged that finding of fact on appeal.
Because the court reached the correct conclusion, we haven't challenged that finding of fact. However, the court was utilizing that presumption incorrectly because he did not take the facts of 1908 into account when he applied that presumption. In 1908, we had a homesteader, Mr. Harper, who was next door to another homesteader who sold in 1910 to the Thompsons. Looking at the purpose of that presumption that it's wild, unenclosed, and unimproved is to protect the Serbian landowner from surprise. When someone is traversing a wild and unenclosed and unimproved property, there is no notice to the Serbian estate owner that that person crossing is trying to establish a right. Okay, so there's a purpose behind the presumption. In this case, in 1908, there was a homesteader using a roadway across another homestead's property, and that homesteader was farming this parcel of property, establishing a homestead. So the facts of this case show that that presumption should not be applied.
And so are you challenging that finding of fact or not? I'm just trying to figure that out.
I am challenging that finding of fact. I think that's incorrect because the court strictly adhere to these presumptions that don't apply to the facts of this case. So, for example, fast forward 112 years to today, when Mr. Van Orden enclosed his property, there were 30 motorcyclists and ATV riders crisscrossing his property. That presumption would apply because that particular use would not put a Serbian landowner on notice that any of those motorcyclists were utilizing the property to establish a claim of right. But in 1908, when you have a single homesteader next to another homesteader, and he's utilizing the road across that homestead, there is no presumption that it was permissive because, in fact, I would argue it falls in our favor because when a homesteader is utilizing the road to homestead a piece of property that uses that road, would indicate a claim of right to that road. And that's underscored by the testimony of Shirley Thompson. If you remember in the record, Shirley Thompson, when she, in the early 60s, when she married into this family of the Thompsons, they came across the Harpers, and Shirley asked her husband, Ted Thompson, what are the Harpers doing here? And Ted Thompson said, well, those are the Harpers. They own property up there. They have a right to be here. That was her testimony. Ted Thompson didn't come up with that statement in that moment, I don't believe. That would have been learned from his father and perhaps even his grandfather, that the Harpers were utilizing that roadway as a right, and the use in 1908 would underscore that, not contradict it, because the facts and circumstances of 1908 were much different than the facts and circumstances of today. So I believe that the judge did get it wrong when he asserted that it was permissive use and applied a presumption unnecessarily and failed to consider the facts of 1908 and the facts of this case. In fact, not only was there no evidence presented at trial, the court even said in his first decision that the record is too vague to come to any conclusion about the state of the property prior to 1962. And so for him then in this clarification memorandum to go against that, I believe, was a mistake and an error. But ultimately, because he got it right, we did not prosecute that issue. And so there was no reason for the district court to apply a presumption. There was no need to fill in the blanks, and he failed to take the facts of this case into account and look at the purpose of the presumption. presumption that he applied.
Counsel, to what degree, if any, was there any change in the status of the facts that were found by the court between the trial, which took place in Tower 1, and then the court's decision that resulted in this appeal?
No, Your Honor, there were no factual, there were no additional hearings, there was no additional testimony or supplements to the record offered.
No affidavits or anything?
Nothing that I'm aware of. I don't recall a single declaration or any other facts or testimony that would have supplemented that decision. However, I believe the court did ask for supplemental briefing for us to assert what we believe the court meant by Copeland, but that was all argument or additional facts. It's also important to look at the purpose behind this presumption that the parties use the vote of honor. So the reason why there's a presumption in other cases that says the common use of a roadway or public use of a roadway is a presumption of permission is because the presumption, we don't want to, again, take the servient landowner by surprise. If there's a road that everybody's using, how is the servient landowner to know that one of those users is asserting a claim of right? And again, in this case, the Thompsons testified that they knew the Harkers were using that road to access their property. They knew the Harkers were farming. They knew the Harkers were not asking permission. And so it would be error to apply that similar presumption to the facts of this case. And I think what the court is instructing the bar and the district judges is, in other cases there are missing facts, and in cases where we're missing facts, we can assert presumptions to show that the use was permissive. But in this case, both with the 1908 use and the testimony of the Thompsons and the common roadway use and the testimony of the Thompsons and the Harkers, there's no need to apply those presumptions.
And what was the evidence pertaining to the 1908 use that is in the record that you believe should have prevented the district court from applying the presumption in this case?
There was no evidence in the record whatsoever as to the state of the property in 1908. There were no photographs. There was no testimony. There was no indication whether or not the fences and crops are existing. There was no indication of whether or not of when the parties moved to the area and started farming and then applied for the homestead. We do know that Harper was there in 1908 and that he received a deed from President Hardy after his widow applied for that. But as far as what fences existed, what crops were there, and what improvements were there, you just don't know. And according
to... wasn't there a finding that it was wild and unenclosed, and that's never been challenged?
There was no finding that it was wild and enclosed. There was an assumption by the court thinking, well, it was 1908 and there were two homesteaders in the area. It must have been sagebrush. But there's no evidence in the record whatsoever. So for the court to jump to that conclusion, I think would have been error because there's nothing indicating what the state of the property was.
Wouldn't you be presuming adverse use under your theory? He's making a presumption, he's jumping to a conclusion that this, because there's no evidence, then it must have been adverse.
Well, we're not asking this court to reverse an instruction to find adverse use for 1908. I'm saying if there is a presumption to be made, which I don't believe there needs to be a presumption for 1908, then it would fall in our favor, because back in 1908, two neighboring homesteaders trying to establish their rights to ownership would have been utilizing a roadway for access, and that certainly would have fallen in favor of a claim of right of use of a road other than just an unknown use. This notice issue goes back to what are these serving estate owners being notified of? Are we being notified that these strangers are claiming the right to our property? I think that's required. But in 1908, sparsely populated homesteads,
So in HFLP, this court said that the presumption, of course, I understand where you're coming from now a little better than I did, the presumption continues of permissive use until a hostile and adverse use is clearly manifested and brought home to the serving of property owners. I just need to know from your perspective when it was brought home by your client.
Well, the only evidence in the record is that it was brought home at the time Shirley Thompson testified that Ted Thompson's practice was to never challenge the Harkers' use because they had a right to be there. That is the event in the record that we key upon. It's the first event that we have evidence of. No one else was alive to testify prior to that date. And so as of that date, it was clear from Ted Thompson's testimony that it was the Thompson family practice not to challenge the Harkers' right. And to the extent that the district court jumped to the conclusion that it was wild, open, and enclosed, and applied a presumption, we believe that was unnecessary. It was not based on facts in the record, and it was maybe in response to his desire to clarify from 1908, but we never asked for a prescriptive easement from 1908 moving forward. We asked from the evidence moving forward, which was 1962.
So the district court, when he makes his finding of wild, unenclosed, and unimproved, it appears he relies on the fact it wasn't fenced until the Van Ordens fenced it as the evidence that it was unenclosed. And then in terms of the wild and unimproved, he relies on the testimony of Shirley Thompson that originally a lot of the property was sagebrush and pretty undeveloped. And so help me understand why you don't think that's substantial and competent evidence that supports his conclusion that in 1908 it was wild, unenclosed, and unimproved.
A large part of this property is still undeveloped and unimproved. There's sagebrush and juniper trees and barren hillsides everywhere along this property. There are a large portion of this property still unimproved. There were fences existing at the time of Shirley Thompson's testimony. There have been fences there for a long time. There's old fences in the property, but the testimony that the property was not fully enclosed until Van Ordens fully enclosed it is a result of Van Ordens being ranchers and cattlemen, and they fully enclosed it to keep cattle in, but there were roads, there were fields, and there were some old fences there in 1962. And there, when Shirley Thompson testifies, well, a lot of property was just saved for Lester and that's true today. That entire hillside is relatively unimproved and barren. Ted Thompson farmed it and the Harkers farmed it, so there were fields, but in between the fields, I point you to the original record, page 29. There is a map that, kind of an overhead Google map, and it'll show the roadway coming from the county road, and it goes through, meanders through some of the defendant's properties, and then enters into the Van Orden properties, goes past some fields, then there's a bunch of barren property, and then there's the tower, and then goes through some undeveloped property, and then probably even today is unimproved. So I don't give that any weight to the court's decision that you found that as of 1962 that prior to that date there was nothing there. That's just not accurate in the record. But it also, I will mention that a portion of the roadway, as you look at that map on page 29 of the Cook 1 record that was attached as a supplement, the roadway, this common use argument that how can the Harkers use of a roadway that the Thompsons also use establish adverse use? As you look at that roadway, it goes past what the Thompsons utilized as fields, then it gets to the tower, and then it takes a left and goes down a hill into the Cook property. So not the entire road was not commonly used by the public, certainly, and it was not used by the Thompsons but for to access the Cook property. So there was a portion of that roadway that was not used in common. common. And again, I think that helps us with the facts of this case, where we say, do all presumptions apply to all cases? I think the court wants us to disentangle ourselves from all presumptions to all cases. Are there missing facts in this case? And if there are missing facts, what are the facts of this case? What presumptions would apply to this case? And in this case, where the Thompsons, that presumption of common use road is really a notice protection for the surgeon of the state. It's much like the wild, unenclosed, and unimproved presumption. It's there to protect Serbian estate owners from the surprise of someone out of nowhere saying, well, I've been using this road for over the prescriptive period. But in facts of this case, where the Thompsons have testified, we knew exactly where they were, we knew exactly what they were doing, we understood they had a claim of right, we acted accordingly, and they acted accordingly. These presumptions do not need to invade this case, because there's no blanks to fill in. And the facts of this case are different than the facts where those presumptions were applied in other cases. The presumptions are not elements. We have five elements. And then when we have elements that need information, and we have facts that need some presumptions, fine, we can apply those presumptions. But we do not want to, to my view, this disentanglement process that the court has spelled out in Cook 1 and prior cases is to say these presumptions are not to be used as elements. Look at the facts, look where your holes are, and you can apply these. And in this case, we have the testimony of Shirley Thompson that the Thompsons were on notice. And so that's...
So Mr. Stenquist, I understand your argument to be that the presumption does not apply. If we disagree and conclude that the presumption applies, do your client still win?
Yes, it was error to apply that presumption.
You have misunderstood my question. My question is, if we apply the presumption and we conclude that it was applicable under these circumstances and disagree with your assessment of when and how a presumption should be applied, do your client still win?
I believe so. And that is because in 1962, Shirley Thompson testified that it was their practice to stop everyone and turn them around and try to regulate that road. But the Harkers used it without such hindrance. And the Harkers went up there at their own will. And their actions were adverse, and Shirley testified that occurred in, at least in 1962. There's also testimony that the Grovers needed to ask permission, and they were actually plaintiffs in this case, and next door neighbors to the Cooks, almost sharing the identical road. And so we have a set of facts where you can't just assume that permission was granted to the Cooks because of acquiescence or inaction. You have to take the testimony of Shirley Thompson and the behavior of the parties, where the Grovers were required to ask permission to use the identical road, and the Cooks were not. So I would contend that the actions of the parties were sufficient to bring it home. I think that was just Seven's question. I think that's what he was alluding to earlier. Is there an event, or is there something to bring it home? And I believe that those facts in the record are enough to bring it home.
I don't know that I've heard either counsel speak to this notion that the public's use of the road was equivalent to that of the Harker family's use. Do you want to address that point of this? It seems to me the public's use is just the same as the Harker's, and there's no adverse claim of right here. Our case law pretty well says that, but I don't know the other parties that address public use. I'm looking at page 130 of the record, but page 36 of his opinion. Shelley Cook conceded the public's use of Tower Road by vehicle was no different than Harker family's use of Tower Road. Indeed, their response to the first set of discovery, Cook stated the Tower Road was used by the community in traversing the area and was considered a public thoroughfare.
That was not proven trial. That was an assertion that was raised initially when not all the facts were known. Once the testimonies were taken, that issue, that it was an easement by public use, was dismissed by the court. The facts and testimony of the case are that the Thompsons lived not on the hillside, but below the hillside, and watched for people. And when they saw people using that road, they would go up and see what they were doing. And if they knew them, they would give them permission to continue. And if they didn't know them, they would turn them around. And so to the extent that there was an assertion that it was a public thoroughfare, that was incorrect and not established. In fact, the road ends the Cook property. And so the road past the tower just goes to the Cook's property. So to the extent that Shirley Thompson may have testified that the harp that the Cooks used or the Harpers used was no different than other people she may have met, that they were just traveling along the road with the vehicle. But remember, there is evidence in the record that the Harpers farmed that property, that their use was unique to that of the public. They harvested crops, they leased it, they went up whenever they wanted, and they had a key to the gate, which would show that they used it how they wanted to. And Matt Thompson testified they turned people around and tried to patrol it. Obviously, it was a large area. There were common trespassers, but this was not something where the public utilized it as a thoroughfare for ingress and egress. It ingressed and egressed to the Cook property.
I thought there was some reference to someone bringing Boy Scouts to camp out there and recreate on the property.
Yes.
Not just using the road as a thoroughfare, but actually recreating on this property.
And the only testimony in that regard is actually helpful for our case. That was John Harper Jr., who took Mr. Cook as a young boy because he grew up in the area. You know, married a local gal, so he knew the Harper family. So Mr. Harper was Mr. Cook's scoutmaster, and Mr. Cook, in support of their testimony that Harper's never asked permission, testified that he went up there with Mr. Harper, not the general public, but he went up with Mr. Harper, and during their trips as scouts to visit Mr. Harper's property, Mr. Harper never asked for permission to take the scouts up there. So to the extent that the scouts were up there, the only testimony on the record is Mr. Cook's testimony that he utilized it with Mr. Harper not asking for permission. And again, I believe that prescriptive element that it was used as a public thoroughfare is defeated by the testimony of Shirley Thompson, where she says, I knew they were using it under a claim of right, because the public thoroughfare exception, that public thoroughfare exception is, again, to put the serving and his stakeholder on notice that someone's utilizing the property under claim of right. So public thoroughfare in and of itself doesn't defeat a prescriptive easement. If the serving and his stakeholder knows that the Harper family is using that public thoroughfare under a claim of right. And so even if there were evidence that other people utilized the road, the Thompsons testified we knew at least the Harpers were utilizing it under a claim of right. And I think that's an important distinction when you start thinking about these presumptions that are attempting to defeat the clear evidence of this case. I think everything else that we have is, for example, the attorney's fees argument. And the details in the cases are in our briefing. If you have any more questions, that's all I have.
Fergus? Attorney Clerk, how much time is left for you, Tom?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Sure.
I think we first need to talk about the challenging of the finding of fact by the trial court. That's not an issue on appeal. It wasn't raised in the briefing. This court in Cook 1 even stated, on appeal, this court will set aside finding of fact only if they're clearly erroneous. Even if
it is conceptually this idea of a challenge is found in the brief somewhere. There is no argument or showing that this finding of fact is clearly erroneous. It is supported by the evidence.
Be specific, which finding of fact?
The finding of fact that the Van Orden property was wild, unenclosed, and undeveloped at the time, at all times relevant to the prescriptive use. In particular, Shirley Thompson testified, as the trial court noted, that the property was unimproved and basically sagebrush until it was being farmed. The evidence is that they did not start to farm. The Van Orden property was not farmed until into the 1962 at the earliest. And so it's not until that point in time that there is any evidence of any development or improvement of the land. To the extent that it constitutes improvement, the improvement is just farming the property. There's no other evidence of any other development at that time. Kind of on this same note about the common use with the public as well as with the Thompsons that...
Hang on just a second before you move to common use. The briefing that the respondent submitted as it relates to this issue of the presumption, the wild and unenclosed, the heading is, the certainty of the state was not wild, unenclosed, and unimproved during the statutory period. So from 1962 onward. Is that the proper focus for this issue?
No, Your Honor. The presumption, the proper focus is when the use began, and that use began in 1908. The prescriptive period that the trial court establishes in 1908 is when the use began. When the use of Tower began is when the Van Orden property was wild, unenclosed, and undeveloped. That's when the presumption attaches to the use of Tower Road and continues until there's some independent hostile act that, as the Chief Justice pointed out, is brought home to the owners of the serving state.
All right, so when we're looking at whether a determination of wild, unenclosed, and uninhabited, we're looking at the 1908 period, and that's the evidence in the record that we're considering.
That's correct. And there's other evidence that is there as well. I think it's so obvious that we sometimes overlook it. That's the fact that the Cooks were homesteading this. And so their predecessors in interest, anyways. The Cook property was being homesteaded. That by its very nature indicates that it was wild, unenclosed, and undeveloped. As well, the Van Orden property, there's no evidence of it being purchased or ownership of that property being acquired by anyone until 1910, at least 2 years after the Cook property is being homesteaded. And so there is other evidence from which this court could determine that the Van Orden property was wild, unenclosed, and undeveloped. And it was brought up that there were some fences. There is testimony that there were some fences at some time, but there was never evidence that the property itself was enclosed.
So can you respond to Mr. Stenquist's argument that the presumption shouldn't apply here at all? The presumption only applies when there's no evidence either way. In this case, we have evidence that as of 1962, there was this, whether you want to call it family lore or whatever, that had been passed down, that we allow them to use the road because they have a right to use it.
So, you cannot have a prescriptive easement if there's been permissive use of the property. This court, the Idaho Supreme Court has stated that they don't want trial courts engaging in or getting entangled in burden shifting. But even this court in Cook 1 cited favorably to the presumption, including the presumption in this case of permissive use if the serving estate is wild, unenclosed, and undeveloped. And so that presumption arises. It's a presumption of adverse use that arises if the beginning of the use is unknown or uncertain and the other elements have been satisfied. The presumption of permissive use arises if there is information about when the use began, which is the case, which is the facts of this case, the circumstances of this case. If there is enough evidence for the trial court to determine that the Van Horn property was wild, unenclosed, and undeveloped when the alleged prescriptive use began.
Right, but as I understand Mr. Stenquist's argument, he's saying that doesn't apply in every situation where the land is wild, unenclosed, and unimproved. We only apply it when we have no information either way on how the use arose. And he's saying in this instance, we have testimony indicating there was this information passed down between generations that they have a right to use this road, and so therefore we don't interfere with their use the way we do with other people. So he's saying that's your evidence that their use began as adverse and under a claim of right, and therefore you never apply the wild, unenclosed, and unimproved presumption. What's your response to that?
There is no evidence of any adverse use at any point in time in this case. And so there's the information about how the use began is that the use did not begin as adverse to anyone's rights in the property. I think Mr. Stenquist comes from a position that an assumption that merely that if the parties believe it's a prescriptive easement or some other identified property right, that that's sufficient to establish adverse use. But again, it's about the nature of the use itself when we're determining whether or not a prescriptive use has been established. Not just the party's mindset or their beliefs about the rights or their use. And so the nature of the use at the commencement when the property was being, when the Cook property was being homesteaded, there's no evidence that the use at that time was adverse. The only evidence you have, and my reading of the presumption and how this court has applied the presumptions, and including its reference to it in Cook 1, it doesn't apply from the beginning. It's a presumption about permissive use and can be used to determine how that use began if the evidence supports that presumption.
But can't you infer that from the statement, the testimony, we stop everybody, recognition that their use of the road is adverse to our property right, except for these people, because they have a right to be there, evidence of a claim of right. So when you look at that statement, doesn't that establish they recognize use of the road other than by themselves as adverse, but they believe these people are using the road under a claim of right?
So they, again, the evidence doesn't establish that they stop everyone. That there is evidence and testimony that other people, the general public, use it just as they did. And that it was the language that was used as a public thoroughfare was from written discovery response signed by Roger Cook. That's not just something that was unproven or just out there or an assumption. That's evidence of how this road was being used. The stopping of the public, the testimony about that isn't until in the 1960s, after the presumption would have arisen. There is no, I think Mr. Stenquist argued this directly to the court, that they don't have evidence about that early period. That's the very same thing to this court, is there's a lack of this evidence about that time period and the use of Tower Road and the condition. There may not be evidence of the use of Tower Road at how it started, but there is evidence of what the condition of the serving estate was like when that use began. And that raises the presumption of permissive use.
It seems to me that evidence that we stop everyone except these folks who have a claim of right, that's evidence of a belief. But is that evidence of how the use started?
It's not. And as well, it's not adverse use in and of itself. That argument can use both to... And the evidence of that is only from, again, the 1960s. It's not evidence of how the use began in 1908 or any conduct in 1908. There's no evidence of any conduct on the part of the dominant estate users using Tower Road until the 1960s after this presumption would have already arisen. So that would not, it's just not a concern or a factor that would undermine any of the arguments that presented.
Interesting. With that, this matter is now under advisement. The court will render a decision in due course. So thank you for your time. Those who visit us, thank you for your time.
All right.